Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to this fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming your way via the internets from San Francisco. I'd like to thank four people who helped make this show possible today. They're voluntary subscribers to the PBC show: Rita Sheldrake, Marilyn Ryan, Gary Batterson, and Deborah Gordon. If you're able to help and you'd like to, just log on to my website at peterbcollins.com, and PayPal will line you up for a monthly subscription for as little as $5 a month. And later in this podcast, Gary Chu, our official film reviewer, returns to tell us about the flick called The Kids Are All Right. Sounds pretty exciting. There's sex on the screen. Our intro music today from the incredible Timmy Thomas. And it's a theme that permeates the book Eating with the Enemy. The song, of course, is Why Can't We Live Together? Robert Egan joins us from Cubby's Barbecue in Hackensack, New Jersey, where he has been waging diplomacy for many years now. Bobby, welcome to our program.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Peter. I appreciate it.
Well, I have to tell you, this is a fascinating book, and your co-author, Kurt Pitzer, really captured your voice. And first of all, you describe a lot of meals in the book, and it makes me want to just jump through the phone over to Cubby's right now and order a slab of ribs.
Oh, we're a specialist in baby back ribs imported from Denmark. We slow cook them and fall off the bone type of barbecue.
Oh, boy, that I haven't had lunch yet, so that sounds real tasty.
Come on out.
And give us a little scene setter, because Cubby's is where a lot of these important meetings take place that you describe in the book. So give our listeners a little snapshot. How many tables do you have? What's the kind of traffic there, the customer base that you have? Give us a picture.
We're a roadhouse type of a restaurant, counter service, 60 seats, quick service. We, I guess you could say it would be a log cabin type of setup without the actual logs.
Mm-hmm.
But if you looked at it, it looked like a little roadhouse out in the country someplace.
And you're not far from the freeway there, right?
No, we're right off of Route 80. We're sandwiched between Route 80 and Route 4,
mm-hmm.
very close to the Jersey Turnpike.
Yeah.
We're a quarter mile south of the Bergen County Courthouse, so we're in the hub of Bergen County.
And critically, you're within 20 miles of Manhattan, so the diplomats who don't have actual, you know, full diplomatic privileges could come to Cubby's without getting in trouble with their handlers.
Yeah, we UN is probably as the crow flies, 5-6 miles away,
mm-hmm.
a little bit more. You know, go across the George Washington Bridge and then down the Harlem River Drive to the UN. Without traffic, about 15 minutes.
And so describe your customers, because it seems to me that first the Vietnamese and then the North Koreans, who became regular patrons and who you started working with in a diplomatic way, would have really stood out at Cubby's.
Well, you know, Bergen County is a very ethnically diverse county in New Jersey. We have a large Asian population, Hispanic, African-American, Italian, Irish. So it's a melting pot, you know, for everybody, all racial backgrounds. We have, I would say, probably a 15% Asian clientele at Cubby's.
Mm-hmm.
So they blended in pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
you know, certainly we never hid from them, my customers, the fact that they were from enemy states, Vietnam or the DPRK.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my customers were aware of, you know, what I was doing at the time and who I was doing it, because we memorialized a lot of what I did with certain media publications.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And this was to keep me on the right side of the Logan Act.
Now, Bobby Egan, tell our listeners about your background, because you really trained for a career in diplomacy. You got that PhD from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
I took the short course, the mafia course.
So you were the guy who cut
blue collar town.
And you
one
cut
of my mentors, the guys that I looked up to when I was growing up, was the guy that I worked for, Bobby Vesco.
Uh-huh.
I was a young kid. I used to cut his lawn and pull trap for him at the local trap range. I knew my only way out of the neighborhood was through my relationships, not what I knew, but who I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the ticket that, you know, we learned early on in life would get us someplace. You know, similar, I guess, how New Jersey politicians are looking at things nowadays. It's not what they know, it's who they know.
Well, yeah.
You know, similar to the corruption we have here in North Jersey. It's well-rooted.
Yeah.
But you know, I knew that, you know, I didn't have the, there weren't any empowerment programs when I was growing up
mm-hmm.
that they have for the kids today. There was no play dates. We were out there hunting and fishing when we were 10, 11, 12 years old.
Yeah.
I had my first gun when I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you got in trouble, you got cracked over the head. You didn't get a time out.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, we were, as males in the household, we were expected to earn a living.
Mm-hmm.
The empowerment of going off to college wasn't an option for us. Nobody was going to send some poor Irish, Italian, white kid from North Jersey to college. It just didn't happen. I certainly didn't have the discipline to do well enough in high school, nor did I have the guidance. All my uncles and my dad were hot tar roofing contractors, and I was expected to be the same.
And you started off in the roofing business, and you used to blow your paycheck on Coke on the weekends?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Get an 8-ball here and there, and certainly I looked at it. Most of the roofers that we were, you know, as I grew up, had a alcohol problem, so I wanted to stay away from the alcohol. So it seemed like I took a better route and, you know, tried the non-addictive course, cocaine. At the time, people didn't acknowledge that coke was physically addictive, and I fell into that route for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
I rehabbed myself out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly, when I started taking the relationship serious with the Vietnamese, I clearly understood that it was time for me to clean my act up, and I checked myself in rehab, got cleaned up, and got out of that life.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it certainly gave me the wherewithal to, when I traveled overseas, when I dealt with these nations that illegally deal drugs, and I went to areas of countries where there was drug warlords, and certainly there was a lot of wheeling and dealing in the black market with arms.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the background that I had growing up, the street background that I had, this wasn't that unusual to me. So it didn't seem, I didn't seem out of place there. I was certainly not, you know, taken back or intimidated by the type of people that later on in life that I would have to deal with, the undesirables. I knew how to handle them. And I think because of what I went through in the past, it set me up to be able to handle to go to Vietnam, North Korea, and deal with some of these rogue nations.
You dealt with Iraqis for a while, too. But to me, some of the people you really stood up to were officials of our own government, the FBI people who were sent to keep tabs on you.
Yeah, well, what happened was, you know, the FBI, from when I was a young guy and, you know, cutting Bobby Vesco's lawn, we developed a little bit of a relationship back then. Certainly when I brought the Vietnamese government official Lê Quang Khai out to testify about the secret prison system in Vietnam and exactly where one of those prisons were, the FBI took a keen interest in me, especially after when I started to develop a relationship with North Korea. That's when they decided that not only was I going to be a source of theirs, but I was going to be an operative for them, that for me to go ahead with my relationship with North Korea, in And they said because of the nuclear consequences to develop this relationship, where they were in an impasse with North Korea, our government and North Korea over the development of North Korea's nuclear weapons at the time. This is before they had those weapons. The FBI said, not only are you going to inform for us, but we're going to make you a full-fledged operative.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no choice in the matter, and I did it. I became an operative for Squad I-28, a counterintelligence over in New York, and the North Koreans knew it as well. I let them know. They expected it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was more, the FBI didn't quite want me to be that conduit between both countries, but that's what I became. They would just rather me be an operative for them and feed information back to them, establish a relationship, the type of relationship that the Bureau wanted me to develop with North Korea. But instead, I developed a relationship that I thought would benefit both the DPRK, North Korea, and the United States.
Yeah, you created a back channel, but you really did it on your own terms.
Yes, exactly. And I think the FBI was taken back by that, Bobby Egan did it on his terms, not theirs.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go back, because as a teenager, it appears you were just a little too young to get into the military for Vietnam. And so you kind of created your own interest and cause in the missing prisoners of war from North Vietnam. And you got involved with some groups. You met with Ross Perot at one point. He gave you his home phone number. And you started to see that you could be powerful and influential in your own way without being a State Department official or a pointy-headed intellectual. You're just a real guy. You're not even very political. You seem to hate both political parties almost equally.
Yeah, well, it's not that I hate them. It's just that, I do what every American should do, is keep tabs on our own government. What I thought, during the Vietnam War, we prepared ourselves to go to war. We weren't going to college, so the only alternative was, we were going to be the one, type of kids that would get drafted. We prepared ourselves for that. When the war concluded, through the preparation, I got to, I learned quite a bit about the Vietnamese and was keeping tabs on the war and learned in certain type of what the Vietnamese mindset was on keeping the prisoners and the different factions in Vietnam, how they all worked together to defeat the Americans. It wasn't just one central government in Hanoi. They had relationships with the Khmer Rouge, the Pathet Lao, mountain people. And what I didn't understand was that so quickly that North Vietnam returned the 500-and-something POWs out of Hanoi, but the war wasn't over. We had still had an occupying force in South Vietnam. The war ended in 75, not 73, so when Nixon said all the men came home, I knew that was impossible, because we still hadn't recognized the fact that we were making war in Laos, that we invaded
mm-hmm.
Laos.
Right.
We were fighting the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. Certainly there were hundreds and hundreds of men missing in both countries. The Viet Cong, who occupied a good part of South Vietnam, still were at war with us. South Vietnam was still under the control of the South Vietnamese. It wasn't, that war wasn't over, so it was very highly unlikely that the Viet Cong would have returned their prisoners. So I knew that this at the end of the war, Nixon said all the men were home. I knew that was impossible. In 1975, when Hanoi finally invaded Ho Chi Minh City, and the war concluded, and no men were returned from the Viet Cong or the Path of Lao, I knew that there were live men still being held.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't seem this government was doing anything about it. So the long and the short of it, I got involved in the POW-MIA movement, met a lot of great people, worked with our government during that time. I went to Vietnam, worked with the central government of Vietnam. I worked with the Department of POW Affairs over in Vietnam, help facilitate excavation sites on live Americans. We did some research and in the War Museum in Hanoi. We tried to get the Vietnamese to admit to having the secret prison system where they held men, how they collectively transported men from Laos to North Vietnam, from Vietnam to Russia. So we worked that route. And it enlightened me, and it gave me an opportunity through the UN. I developed a relationship with the central government of Vietnam through the their mission to the UN. In spite of the fact that we didn't have relationships with the Vietnamese, mm-hmm. It was considered an enemy state, I still had access to them through their UN mission. And that's where I developed a relationship, and that relationship carried over to Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
And through that relationship, I'd like to think we contributed to help the process along in the accounting of missing Americans.
Now, we'll get to it in a bit. You also tried to work on POW-MIA issues related to the Korean War much further back. But let me just ask your observation, because I've found that as I've looked at these issues, and you know, I've been doing talk shows since the 1970s, Bobby, that our government has never made a clear priority out of really discovering the issues of the POW-MIAs, and in the case of those still alive, trying to bring them home alive, and in the case of those who were killed, a proper and respectful treatment of their remains. And it was always used as kind of a political chip, regardless of the administration. And even as time continued to burn away over the years after we left Vietnam, I never felt that even a military man like Jimmy Carter gave it his highest priority.
Well, they all say it's the highest national priority. And that kind of gave my cover to, you know, possibly cross the line and break some U.S. laws by dealing with these enemy states, traveling the way I did, because the presidents, all of them, the last six or seven presidents, have said it's the national highest priority to account for our POWs. So I took that, you know, on a very serious note. I established relationships, and we tried the best we could to try to get these guys home. We know that they were left behind. We know that the Pentagon has done everything they can, because I guess they'd be quite embarrassed if it came out that they left after fighting these wars, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the secret war in Laos, the secret war in Cambodia. If it came out that they knowingly left live men behind, it'd be a big embarrassment to the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
So they've done everything they could have. They've done everything they can to cover it up. Matter of fact, in the book I talk about, in 1997, there was a submarine incident where a North Korean submarine washed ashore in South Korea.
Right.
A big international incident. It was stopping Kido. The South Koreans were ready to invade North Korea. The North Koreans were willing to release several Americans that they had in North Korea, that they openly admitted to having. Ambassador Han told Bob Burns from the Associated Press there was up to 11 Americans being held in North Korea. They were willing to release those Americans to bypass an apology to South Korea about that submarine incident. In the book, I discuss the conversations that I had during those negotiations with the National Security Council. I was the conduit during this critical period in U.S.-North Korean relations. During that crisis, I was the conduit between the White House and North Korea. And North Koreans put those men on the table. The White House walked away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Clinton administration that did it. I have a lot of respect for Bill Clinton. He just didn't think that Kim Jong-il would hand over those men. And in fact, a few years later, Kim Jong-il handed over several Japanese citizens that they kidnapped, admitted to, you know, the Japanese that they had a program of kidnapping foreigners, and handed them over and released them after 20-something years.
Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with that, right?
Yes, I am. So, Bobby,
the fact that
go ahead.
Kim Jong-il had the wherewithal to admit to having programs of keeping foreigners. And the Clinton administration got back to me and said the only reason that they're not going to go ahead with this is that they don't think Kim Jong-il would admit to having these programs. And I said he's ready. that these were programs that his father, you know, had instituted in the past, had established, and these were programs that were working well before he took power. And he was, at that time, willing to negotiate those 11 Americans.
Now, Bobby, like you, I have never met Kim Jong-il. I only know about his public persona, his, you know, eccentricities, the big hair, the huge outsized ego. But one of the things that, as I was reading the book, occurred to me several times was that his underlings, including your main contact, Han Song-ryol, they had to live in constant fear of what he might do next because he's so unpredictable. And so one of the things that really seemed interesting to me was that you were able to build these relationships. You were able to operate as a back channel and essentially conduct certain negotiations with the North Koreans. But both you and they never knew exactly what the reaction would be from the very top.
Well, we had an idea. I mean, dictators are more predictable than you think they are. You know where they're coming from. They're repressive. They're scary type of people. They're certainly people that, you know, are used to having their own way. And you've got to appeal to their egos. You can't be larger than them. You have to at all times appear to be serving them. They have to be the guy that's always in charge. And when you operate under those rules and guidelines, you know what you can expect from them. You know what you're going to get and what you're not going to get. You know, certainly we say they're so unpredictable. Well, I think, you know, at times dictators can be very predictable because you know exactly where they're coming from. They shoot it straight.
Mm-hmm.
There's no politician around with them. They're not, you know, they're not looking to be politically right. So, you know, so from my standpoint and from the North Korean officials that we worked, you know, with, certainly we were all at times in fear of what the consequences of our actions could be. We were always taken in consideration with His Excellency's, how he would react to what we were doing. But we had much more leeway at times with the dictator than we had with a sitting president, believe it or not. I mean, I brought them here. We discuss it in the book. I brought them down to assist during Hurricane Katrina. And one of the stipulations were, I thought it was a good idea, since we've helped them, you know, so many times in the famine and they had a tidal wave over there, the Great Flood.
Mm-hmm.
We assisted them. The United States assisted them with private aid organizations we brought over there. The U.S. government contributed almost $60 million at one time, food aid. During Hurricane Katrina, I thought it would be good for the North Koreans to come over here and assist us. They sent a team of four members from their own flood relief organization over here, and they went down to Florida, and they took a convoy from Florida to Mississippi with America's Heart. They worked for 3 days and handed out medical supplies, and, you know, it was probably more symbolic than anything else, but they, you know, they did, you know, assist people in Mississippi and worked on the food lines and, you know, certainly showed that, you know, they were capable of assisting the United States and helping the needy here.
Mm-hmm.
And that went a long way.
Well, and Bobby, if I may say, you, again, given your background, you have a remarkable sense of the media and of public relations.
Well, let me finish what I was going to say on this.
Okay.
It was part of the condition of them coming over here to get their visas granted,
uh-huh,
was that the State Department put a restriction that the North Koreans weren't to be exposed to any press.
Mm-hmm.
that they couldn't make any statements in the press. Their pictures couldn't be put out in the press. Now, you would expect this to happen in North Korea, not the United States, right?
Yeah.
But that was one of the conditions that the State Department put. They didn't want the American people to know that North Korea was assisting us. They could, you know, on a local level, it was okay.
Yeah.
But they didn't want them to do any press conferences. They didn't want any pictures of the North Koreans taken on that food line or in the convoy. But you would expect, like I said, that to happen in North Korea, not the United States.
Well, particularly under the Bush administration, though, the relationships with the press shifted basically to stenography, and the media pretty well did what it was told. But where I was going, Bobby, is that with the women's volleyball team, on a number of occasions, you showed a real sense, a real flair for public relations, and you were educating the North Koreans on how they could burnish their image in the United States, not in a phony way, but really to convey that they're not all dark, evil, nuclear weapons aspirers.
Well, you're absolutely right. They're human beings. There's a personal side to every single North Korean in North Korea. You can't label them, you know, every person in North Korea is the axis of evil. Every one of them has a mother, father, brother, sister. And these are the, this is the traits that I try to take out, to bring out. When they were here, I wanted to show the American people that these are human beings. These are people that have families. These are people that aspire to have the best for their children, just like we do. They just got caught up in the dictatorship, partly because the United States and Russia divided that peninsula after the Korean War. And so started the Cold War. The Koreans were allies of ours. All of Korea were allies when they were occupied by the Japanese. They fought the Japanese side by side with the United States. The end of World War II, we cut that peninsula in half. We gave half of it to Stalin. What do we expect to, you know, would Stalin install the Stalinist regime? And there we had Kim Il-sung. So we're partly responsible for the repressive government that's been in North Korea for the last 60 years.
We're talking with Bobby Egan here on the Peter B. Collins Show. I recommend his book to you. I read it all the way through and was really fascinated. It's called Eating with the Enemy, subtitled How I Waged Peace with North Korea from My Barbecue Shack in Hackensack. And Bobby, take a minute or two here to tell us, you recount in the book several trips that you made to North Korea. And let's start off with the security arrangements and the fairly obvious surveillance that you were under at all times.
Yeah, when you're in North Korea, you're certainly under 24/7 surveillance. You'll be put. I stayed in guest houses, you know, most of the time, and in between the walls, they'll actually have people in the walls. There's a 4 or 5 foot space between each room.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll have people in between those walls when you're in your room listening to you, watching you. They'll actually have, you know, somebody. I removed one of the covers, walk-through panels to the wall, and I was with a couple guys, business delegation.
Yeah.
And I took the cover off and I showed them the guys in the wall.
Well, and
happened to be a man and a woman, and
yes, tell
on air exactly.
The
details were. But
now, Bobby, we're not bound by the FCC regulations, so you pulled back the panel on the wall, and a female and a male North Korean agent were getting it on.
Yes, they were. Yep. and you know something, that was pretty good. That was okay for me because I let my hair down then.
Uh-huh.
I really seen that. Hey, these guys are just like us. You know, at the time, if you put me in a wall with a female, and I had nothing to do but watch somebody else, you know, got a lot of time to kill.
Yeah, you get tired looking on the other side of the one-way mirror and say, look
yep.
What's right next to me.
But I'll tell you, you know, certainly everybody's, you know, under suspicion in a dictatorship. Especially North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place that they're good friends of mine. But certainly I don't agree on their system. I certainly, I've always encouraged them to change. And it's a place unlike any other place in the world. I mean, you would never, I've been to Vietnam. I've been, all over Southeast Asia. I've been in communist countries, and I've traveled, mostly alone. I've never, ever been so taken back as when the first time I went to the DPRK. North Korea is the most isolated place in the world. It's a 28 million people cult. Mothers watch sons. Sons watch sisters. Parents watch their kids. Kids report on their parents. Everybody's spying on everybody out of fear of the consequences of what would happen if there was even a thought that they weren't loyal to the dictatorship.
Now, Bobby, on two occasions, you submitted to being drugged. They injected you once with what you thought was sodium pentothal, and another time they gave you some happy drugs that you took orally. Why would you permit that? I cringed as I read those passages and just imagined what kinds of things you might have told them when you were drugged up and knocked out.
Well, it certainly, look, I never asked the Dominican or the Puerto Rican guy when I was copping an 8-ball of coke on a Friday night what the chemical makeup of the drug was, and I did it. I put enough of that stuff into my system. So I certainly thought that this country, friends of mine, I was a guest of theirs, they certainly had some questions as to what my intentions were. I had a Vietnamese official, like I said a few years earlier, defect, testified before the U.S. Senate Select Committee. So their suspicions about me were well-founded. And when you bring out an official and he commits an act of treason against another country, and you were the guy responsible for that, certainly there were questions about me. And my intentions were different with North Korea. I knew the rules. We agreed to them. And I had no hesitation. If they wanted to question me, if they wanted to interrogate me, certainly better than getting waterboarded, right? I'd rather take a shot in the ass than get dunked 80 or 90 times. And I trusted them. I had a reaction to the first test. I got a bad infection. But other than that, I have no qualms with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big boy.
Well,
this is a dangerous game. We're dealing with a dangerous regime. We certainly know that when you go into North Korea, your life's in their hands anyway. I mean, certainly they can do whatever they want with me. If they suggest something and I go along with it, my position's a lot better than if I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bobby, tell our listeners about Han, because it appears you developed a pretty good friendship with him, circumscribed by the situation. But you really seem to care about him. And he was there for 4 years. You saw him almost every day. I mean, virtually 5-6 times a week. And then he was sent back to North Korea. And then he returned with a promotion. Tell us a little bit about him, both professionally and personally.
Well, professionally, he's loyal to his country. He certainly is dedicated towards the betterment of his people. Progressing his, moving his country forward, representing his country. He's a proud Korean. He's part of a dictatorship that's very, very repressive. He knows that. He recognizes that. He's a man that's open for change. I believe that the ambassador knows that the DPRK, North Korea, has to change with the times. And he's willing to explore the possibility of change, which is good. On the other note, on the personal note, he's a father of two beautiful daughters, just like I am. Loves his wife. He's a good provider. He was a terrific and loyal friend over the 14 years that him and I worked together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and he was a great fishing partner, man. We fished and we hunted together, and he's a great outdoorsman. He's a tough guy, not a big man. I probably outweighed him by 40, 50 pounds. Certainly, he'd give me a run for my money any day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a tough guy, and that's what I liked about him. He's a blue-collar diplomat, Ambassador Han.
Mm-hmm.
Very well-educated, very intelligent. He got me on the brains department. I got him on the brawn department. Okay? He's a better fisherman than me, but I'm a better hunter. I mean, what Korean isn't a good fisherman, right? I mean, that's their national pastime, I believe, fishing.
Uh-huh.
But he's a terrific guy. He's a guy that'll make you feel comfortable. He, certainly would never talk down to me. He talks right at you. He lets you know what he's thinking. If he's suspicious of your motives, he'll let you know. Your relationship with him isn't fragile. It's not like you're always walking on eggshells. He allows you to make mistakes. He allows you to be you. And he's a guy that likes to have a good time. He'll let his hair down. He'll go fishing. He'll go hunting. He'll go to a barbecue. He went many times to my dad's house swimming. But when it came to business, and when it came to the day-to-day operations of U.S. and North Korean relations, that's when it was time for us to work, and he would let you know that.
Now, I referenced that he was shipped home and then came back with a promotion, and you hint at that interval as a time when he was in a re-education camp or hazed or somehow put through a gauntlet, but you don't really detail it. Is it because he didn't share that with you and you're only speculating, or what?
No, I'm not speculating. There's certain things that, you know, that I know that I don't talk too openly about. They go back towards the re-education centers, what are, you know, similar to I would say they are equivalent to us sending somebody to Gitmo and locking them up for 3 or 4 months and giving them a 24/7 interrogation. They when they're away for a while, especially when they had interactions like he did with me and had the was allowed to be involved in my everyday life, because that was part of the condition that I made when we established this relationship with Ambassador Han. He had to go away, and they had to make sure that he was still loyal to their regime. They're very paranoid. Certainly, they know my background. They know that I've turned communist government officials before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I brought one of them out to testify at the United States Senate Select Committee openly from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
On POWs. We disclosed where there was a secret prison in Hanoi, and that was established. So they had, certainly they were paranoid when he went back of if I turned him. And they had to make sure that he was still loyal to the regime.
Mm-hmm.
And he went through it like a man. He came out smelling like a rose afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
He showed them that he established a good relationship, working relationship with me, a personal relationship with me, but he was still very loyal to the motherland, the DPRK. He was still loyal to North Korea. And with that, he got a promotion. Came back here, and he served another few years.
Mm-hmm. And when was the last time you saw him?
He left. It's been about over 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
2-3 years. But I keep tabs on him. I still have a dialogue with the mission here.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing well. And he's been back a few times, but I haven't seen him.
Yeah.
So until he's ready to reestablish that relationship, I'm not in a working relationship with the North Koreans at this time.
Right.
I still have my established contacts, and we talk once a week. But right now I'm not in a working relationship with them.
Now, Bobby, as we're speaking here at the end of July, we have U.S.-South Korean naval maneuvers underway that appear to be provoking the Kim Jong-il government in North Korea. And they have responded with warnings that they're willing to use a powerful nuclear deterrence and a launch a, quote, retaliatory sacred war. Now, the history here is that North Korea is accused of sinking a South Korean warship a few months back in March, where 46 South Korean soldiers were killed. The North has not acknowledged that it caused this, but that's widely believed by the U.S. and other outsiders. And so the Americans have launched these naval maneuvers with an aircraft carrier leading. What is your take on this, and should we take seriously the threats from North Korea?
Well, first, we should always take seriously any threat, you know, especially coming from a regime that has as large of an army as they do. We have 38,000 troops on the DMZ that are at risk. So certainly any threat should always be taken seriously. This, to me, this is all deja vu all over again. 1996, 97, we had that incident with the North Koreans when that sub washed the shore in South Korea, and they killed a bunch of South Koreans, and they killed their own commandos on that sub before they tried to make way back up to North Korea by land. I think one or two North Koreans got back home. But that was as big of an incident as this is now. At the time, I was embedded in the North Korean mission to the UN, and we tried to negotiate the live POWs back. When that failed, I got them to recognize that the submarine was theirs, and in fact, they did apologize to South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not there now. I don't know who's advising the mission or who's advising the central government, Kim Jong-il's regime. But certainly, it's not being handled very well, and I've told them that. But from their point of view and their perspective, you have to understand there was a couple of North Koreans that were killed in that same area by the South Korean Navy. This looks like, to me, possibly some rogue commander of a sub. You know, you have we have 8,000 pieces. The North Koreans have 8,000 pieces of artillery loaded and pointed at Seoul, South Korea. The distance, less than half the distance from my restaurant to the UN for the last 60 years. So they teach you never to point a gun at somebody because it could be an accidental shooting type of thing. It's dangerous things to do is just to hold a loaded gun at somebody and point it. But there's millions of loaded guns on both sides of that DMZ pointed at big armies. And it's amazing. A million men on either side, millions of pieces of munitions pointed at each other, loaded, ready to fire. And it's amazing that we've only had so few mishaps over the years. It's time for both sides to unload those guns, pack those artillery pieces up in their subs, okay, and move them away from each other, and to start the process of normalized relations with North-South Korea, with North Korea and the United States. And that's the only thing that's going to prevent these loss of lives, such as what we had with the sinking of the South Korean ship. Mm-hmm. Nothing else is going to stop this. History is going to repeat itself. Another couple years from now, we're going to have an incident, the same type of incident. And we'd be very lucky if it's only 40 or 50 men, not 50 or 60,000 men.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is a ticking time bomb. And the world's got to recognize that. The United States has to recognize that. South Korea has to recognize it, as does North Korea. Okay, we have millions of men on each side of that DMZ that are pointing guns at each other. Okay, this is a very, very dangerous situation. Pale in comparison. The 40 souls that were lost in South Korea on that ship, that's pale in comparison as to what's going to happen in the future if the diplomatic process doesn't take root, okay, and we do something about this. Not an armistice. We've got to make a peace agreement. We've got to have normalized relations. Okay, North and South Korea have to coexist together in a peaceful atmosphere, not one that's an armistice, that the war never ended, there's no peace agreement, and both sides still take claim to the other side's countries. The only solution that I can see. But mark my words, if it goes on much longer, there's going to be a far greater loss of life than there's already been. We're very fortunate that there hasn't been a greater loss of life.
Well, Bobby, I thank you, as one American citizen to another, for the commitment that you made to peace and to putting yourself on the line to improve relations with a country that George W. Bush called or tagged as a part of the so-called Axis of Evil. And I want to recommend your book because I found it fascinating, and your voice, now that I've heard it, surfaces in the book in a way that makes me feel like I know you, or at least have spent some time with you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
In closing, I want to ask you to just comment on your acknowledgments, because it's typical for an author to thank all kinds of people, family, friends, and others. And notably, one of your last thanks, you say, "And thanks to the FBI and the National Security Council for absolutely nothing."
Yeah, well, in the end, that's how I felt. There was so much more that could have been done with the relationship that I had generated with the North Koreans, that in the end, the FBI, the National Security Council, walked away from it. And that was during the Bush administration. We had an opportunity to buy their nuclear weapons. We didn't. We had the opportunity to normalize relations, and we didn't. We had the opportunity to buy their missile systems, to disarm them over a 20-year period, and we just walked away from it. And how do I know that? It was I was in the middle of it. Okay, Han was bringing this, to me. I was bringing it to the FBI, the National Security Council, and they just turned their back on it. They just said no, that we're not interested. And I said, well, something, they're going to sell them to our enemies. They're going to sell these systems to somebody else. And our government said, we don't care. We're not buying them. We had an opportunity. We had an opportunity to bring 38,000 American troops off that DMZ and leave the Korean Peninsula in peace. And these intelligence agencies turned their back and walked away. They didn't push the White House hard enough. Walked away from it.
Bobby, it's a real pleasure. Thank you for joining us today. And next time I'm in the Big Apple, I'm going to make a point to drop by Cubby's in Hackensack.
I appreciate that. We'll have a rack of ribs waiting for you.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Robert Bye-bye. Egan, the author of Eating with the Enemy, How I Waged Peace with North Korea from My Barbecue Shack in Hackensack. And I heartily recommend the book to you. Share this podcast with a friend, send them an email, and direct them to peterbcollins.com or iTunes. Now our official big screen film reviewer, Gary Chu, checks in with his review of the new summer blockbuster, The Kids Are All Right.
It's not often you'll hear a mother say to her teenage son, "I wish you were gay, you'd be so much more sensitive." But when you're Julianne Moore acting one of the lesbian moms and The Kids Are All Right, it's just so much routine chatter at the family dinner table. The film's title could mean either that since the kids are straight, they're all right, or that they're all right even though their parents are both female. Let's get this family set in your mind now. First, the all right kids are Joni, played by Mia Wasikowska, and Laser, yes, that's Laser, played by Josh Hutcherson. As mentioned, Moore's character Jules is the non-butch mom, and Nick is, well, I guess you could call her the husband and the father of the family, played by Annette Bening. Nick's an OBGYN. Julie dabbles in landscaping. Joni, obviously named after Joni Mitchell by her same-sex parents, has just graduated from high school and on her way soon to college. Wasikowska looks like she could play Gwyneth Paltrow's sister, but Paltrow isn't in the movie. But Mark Ruffalo is. His character, Paul, looks as if it's been miraculously transported from the 60s. Paul's a laid-back cat who runs a neat little L.A. eatery. Paul also does something else, or I should say did, several years ago. Provides sperm for the pregnancies of Joni and Laser. The kids and moms have not a clue who Donor Dad is, but Joni is out to find out what the male component is in her and her brother's existence. Paul's second mistake may be when he agrees to take a call from Joni, as arranged by the donor facility, and thus meets up with her and Laser at his cool organic diner to catch up, I guess. It's then that the story gets in gear. Nick and Jules, after some coaxing, get with the program going forward, and the mom pops are pretty cool about Paul making a hookup with the family. Everyone's quite adult about it all. After all, this is California. The lesbian filmmaker Liza Cholodenko, who did the well-accepted High Art and Laurel Canyon, directs and shares screenplay chores with Stuart Blumberg. It's not difficult to see where Kids is going. Seems Jules may be a bit bi in her sexual orientation. After Paul commissions her to do some foliage landscaping out back at his place, things slip into a hetero mode as Jules and Paul take a few work breaks in his bed, while Nick's at the clinic. And just because Nick has an MD does mean that she can pick up subtle vibe changes probably more perceptively than most. The Kids Are All Right is low budget. It seems normal no super heavyweight Hollywood producers would be on edge to undertake an R-rated project about lesbian parents with two straight teenagers. Also, some of the camera work leaves a little to be desired, and I'm sure I saw the black nose of a Nerf ball on the business end of a microphone dipping into the frame of at least two scenes with Moore and Benning. Meanwhile, on the other hand, I'm glad films like this are being made. Maybe cinema of such caliber can drag an understanding into America's social consciousness that homosexuals are more like heterosexuals than they are different. Gays and lesbians can and do love and care for others. There is, in the homosexual attitude, a need for family, just as there is promiscuity in either the gay or straight. The Kids Are All Right makes it clear that marriage, whether the parents have plumbing that matches or not, can be a bumpy ride more often than we might want. But doing so, Cholodenko gives time for loads of laughs and a tear or two. Something else I like about this movie is that Cholodenko goes easy on us males. Paul is a pretty loose goose, but a really good guy who deeply cares for those his sperm has wrought. Laser is a great high school kid who, although quite sensitive, is a straight arrow. Sex scenes aren't revealing and played for laughs, especially when Nick and Jules gawk at male gay porn in which there's nothing explicit, but generates a load of mirth. Benning and Moore are simply super as the married couple. Both have taken on many good and important roles, to mention but two for each, Benning in American Beauty and the recent Mother and Child, and Moore in The Hours, and the Oscar-appreciated A Single Man. As she did in A Single Man, Moore particularly caught my eye in a kid's stunning monologue. It occurs after Jules turns off the TV so she can deliver a speech of contrition to Nick, Joni, and Laser. The woman is so real when she does the lines. Watch and listen for them. They're about marriage. Cholodenko might be trying to tell us something. I'm telling you, you can check out my other film reviews at TulsaTVMemories.com or under external reviews at the international movie database IMDb.com. I'm Gary Chu, down in the valley.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Lick that barbecue sauce off your fingers and email Peter at PeterBCollins.com.
Happy trails to you until again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.